Welcome to the Netzpolitik podcast. My name is Markus Beckedahl and my guest today is Andy Pichel.
Bichelbaum.
Bichelbaum,
I guess, yeah.
Is it a German name?
Yeah, it's an Austrian name, actually. It derives from a good Viennese name, Bichelbauer, but it's got an M at the end because I'm Jewish. And so it's a Jewified Austrian name that we found in the Viennese phone book in 2000. We found it in the Viennese phone book, and we were going to do a... We found ourselves accidentally invited to a law conference in Salzburg, and this conference organizers had stumbled on our fake WTO site, invited the WTO, and that was our first false presentation, our first infiltration, and I needed a name, and the Viennese phone book helped.
So it's your artist name.
I guess so, yeah. I guess nom de guerre, war name, as the French say.
Yeah, and you're here at our Republika for the first time because you're one of the members, or one of the two members. How many members do you have of the Yes Men?
We have two members, but we have thousands of people who've helped in different ways. So it's a very giant organization, or a very tiny organization.
Can you give us a brief introduction? What are the Yes Men? What's the idea behind it?
Like, the basic idea of what we do, of the sort of action that we do, is to give journalists excuses, mainstream journalists, the excuse to cover important issues. And basically to find any way that we can to get important issues more coverage, more attention, more further spread out, and really help to spread information that doesn't get spread enough, or ways of seeing things that don't get spread enough. We do that mainly by creating these jokes for the mainstream media, by infiltrating conferences or getting invited where we don't belong. So we pose as corporations that do evil, or government organizations or whatever, and we go and make presentations at conferences. And those presentations can either be representing the corporation or whatever as a monster, more clearly than they really are, or conversely, we can sometimes go to conferences and speak as the entity in question should speak. So like last week, we did our latest action. We posed as the Department of Energy. I was a representative of the Department of Energy, who together with the Department of Defense and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, went to a Homeland Security Congress in Washington, D.C., full of defense contractors, lobbyists, retired generals, and admiral, all these people. And we presented, I spoke on behalf of the Department of Energy and announced that we were going to convert the United States to fully renewable energy within 15 years, by 2030. And this was going to be done in a way that gave ownership of people, American Indians, for example, as well as anybody, ownership of the energy production means. So we wouldn't no longer depend on large companies for our energy. We could produce it ourselves and have local ownership of it. It's a radical solution that, like, nobody actually has this exact proposal. There are visions and plans that show that we could convert to renewable energy in 15 years. That's not a problem. We could do that. We could even still have airplanes, but they would run on hydrogen fuel and it would be produced through wind. And there are ways of doing this with an immense effort. Like, it would be an immense effort, but not the first immense effort we've made in America. There are several such large things that we've done. This might be the largest, but it's possible, and it's what we need to do. But nobody suggests that then you give ownership to the local level and, really have this basically revolutionary plan where people are no longer dependent for basic things on giant corporations. So it's a very radical plan, and the audience applauded throughout the speech, these contractors, lobbyists, basic evildoers, the people that we think of as the dark side. They applauded. And at the end, we had an American Indian friend of ours come up on stage, and he represented the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and he spoke in a very intense, direct way about how much this means to convert to renewables, not only for the entire planet, and not only for all Americans, but especially for Native Americans, who have been victimized first by genocide, and then by fossil fuel extraction, which has demolished enormous areas of land that these reservations, some of them have been completely demolished. Like the tar sands was all native land. Of course, all North America was all native land. But, you know, more recently, the tar sands had been native land, and this fellow is from that area. So he spoke in a very clear way about what this means. And then another Native American, an amazing comedian named Tito Ibarra, got up and led the audience in a circle dance, a supposedly traditional Native American, in quotes, circle dance. Everybody held hands and danced around to his crazy singing. Really bizarre. And the whole thing was like, people were wearing these headbands that we made for them that said Native Headband and a little propeller, a wind energy propeller at the back. So all, and all these like people just having a great time dancing around, knowing exactly what we had proposed, like this revolutionary energy plan. They were celebrating it. And afterwards, a couple dozen people came up and gave me their cards and told me how emotional they felt and how they wanted to be part of this. Of course, part of it is that there were these giant contracts in store for people to, you know, do this. But they were authentically very happy. And the message to me of that whole action is that, you know, there are very few people in the world who actually want the world to be doomed. And those people have a lot of power. But if we take over, if we actually find a way to mobilize and, you know, basically have a revolution of some sort where we force leaders to actually do what is sane, almost everybody will follow. There are very few people who will say, no, 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 I really want to keep burning this crap and making everybody sick and you know, ruining our chances of survival into the next century. Most people will be very happy to go along with it.
And how did it work that you were speaking at this conference?
Well, we got ourselves invited by promising the conference that Colin Powell would come. So they reserved a very special spot at the conference because somebody extremely important was coming, Colin Powell. Colin Powell is involved in this because it's the Department of Defense joint with the Department of Energy and Bureau of Indian Affairs thing. So they expected him to come. We posed as a public relations agency working with the Department of Defense. And we told them that Colin Powell was coming. So they reserved this spot. And the day before the conference, one of the women associated with the conference was about to fly, and she just wanted to check on what was happening, and she making sure everything was in line and okay. And she tried calling Mike's cell phone. Mike was Colin Powell's representative, and he was speaking. You know,
Mike is your partner.
Yeah, Mike, the other yes man. And his phone didn't pick up, so she did the natural thing, and she called the company, the public relations company that we were supposedly a part of, and they said, there's no such person here. What's the phone number that you have for him? And they looked it up, and they couldn't find anything because it's a fake phone number, and they called it, and it was Mike, and they figured out very quickly that he was impersonating this company. And at that point, we were sure it was all over and it was done. But turns out this public relations company didn't call the conference afterwards to tell them that they had figured out we're fake. They just didn't bother. And so we went ahead with it. We were sure it was over, and we were freaking out and sad and depressed, but they didn't tell anybody, so we got to go ahead with it.
And what was the outcome? Was there press coverage, or did you told them at the end it was just a fake?
No, we never told them. We kept telling them Colin Powell was about to arrive. He was about to arrive, and then, like, you know, since he wasn't arriving, I said, well, okay, he was going to go first, but I'll go first, and then he'll arrive, and then he's about to arrive, so I'll just give my speech, and then he'll arrive. And then he still didn't arrive, so then we took a 10-minute break and said, he's going to arrive, and then we left, and then we said, oh, he's going to be here at 3 in the afternoon. We never told them that he wasn't going to arrive. It's terrible. They may still be waiting for him. I don't know. But there was a lot of, yeah, the press coverage is going on now. It's slow, but we're on Democracy Now, and there will probably be some press early this week. So
when did you started with the Yes Man, and what was your, yeah, you talked a bit about your motivation, but what was the inspiring idea?
You know, it really all happened by accident. The closest answer to that, the inspiring idea, would have been the Seattle protests against the WTO in 1999 that shut down the World Trade Organization. And we were inspired to be part of that, to try to do something to support that, to be, you know, to do something that might add something to that, that might get the word out more, that might contribute to greater visibility or whatever. I mean, it already had huge visibility, so whatever. We just wanted to be part of it somehow. It was really for us. It wasn't really for, I mean, it was for the movement, but we really just wanted to be part of the movement because it's such a great thing to do, I guess. And so we made this website, this fake World Trade Organization website, and posted it because I had been playing with websites for a little bit. It was just fun experimentation, but I made a fake Shell website, I made a fake McDonald's website, I realized, oh, I can make fake websites, it's not that hard. And so I made this fake World Trade Organization website, posted it, and we got a little bit of press out of that. We sent it around, it got a little bit of, you know, people started noticing it. And it was really just to do something, you know, really. When I made that, I did not think, like, this is going to matter. I thought, I want to do something, and, you know, at least some activists will see it, and they'll have a laugh. Because it was, you know, there was some funny stuff on the front. So I just thought, at least they'll have a laugh, it'll be nice, it'll, you know, make for some good feelings. Activists need to laugh, it's very important. And what happened next, though, was completely surprising. The World Trade Organization actually noticed it, and they wrote a press release condemning it. They said this kind of thing, making a fake website that looks like ours, undermines our transparency, and it misleads people, and it's very bad. And and they posted that press release on their impenetrable, totally non-transparent website, and nobody noticed. So then they wrote an email, their head of PR, this guy named Jean-Guy Carrier, I think, he wrote an email to us saying, look, you guys, you made this website, you should feel bad for yourselves, you should feel bad about this, you should feel ashamed, and look what you made us do. You made us write this press release. And so we just couldn't believe our luck. We took his email and the press release of the WTO, and we sent out a press release of our own announcing it to thousands of people on our email list who loved it. And it was a very funny thing, and so that got around. They wrote little articles about it. And because of that, because of those little articles on blogs and stuff, search engines started picking it up. And so if you would, you know, search on World Trade Organization, the search engine would go, oh, I know a website that looks like that, that has those words in it, and it would send to ours. And so we started getting a lot of email intended for the World Trade Organization. And we would answer these emails as well as we could. And eventually, you know, and we'd have a lot of fun with it. There's like a whole book full of funny emails back to people inquiring about various issues. And then eventually one day we got an email inviting the head of the WTO to a conference in Salzburg. And we sat on that email for literally 3 months, not knowing what to do. It's just like, it came in and we talked about it, we laughed, and we went, oh my God, okay, what else are we doing? And we just forgot about it. And then 3 months later, I think Mike went, didn't we get an email inviting us to a conference? And I said, yeah, I think we did. And he said, why don't we go? Why don't we do that? And so we wrote back and said, well, I'm sorry, the head of the WTO can't go, but this other person, his assistant, will show up instead. And that was me. And that's how it all got started.
So you often use the media system to hack the media system.
Yeah.
Do journalists laugh at you?
Yeah, weirdly they do. I mean, we send fake press releases a lot. We didn't with this one. But we usually send a fake press release and maybe fool a journalist. Like we issued a press release on behalf of General Electric. It was 2011, a year they didn't pay any taxes. Or maybe it was 2012, I don't know. They didn't pay any taxes. And so we sent out a press release from GE saying they were going to pay I think it was like it was in the billions of dollars. They were going to pay the billions of dollars of taxes that they owed, and they were going to allot it to the right people. And so in this whole utopian press release, one journalist fell for it, an AP reporter, and published it. And very quickly it was found out, but in the moment when it was believed, GE's stock value took a plunge of like $2 billion very briefly and then came right back up. So that made for a big story. Like suddenly all the other journalists had a great time at this poor journalist's expense. And that journalist happens to be Mike's neighbor in Brooklyn, just by chance. And he's no longer angry. But all the other journalists, like, yeah, this is a question. Like, George Monbiot once told me that he had asked various journalists what they thought of the Yes Men, even though we fooled them, and they all love us, because mainly most of them don't get fooled, and most of them understand that what we're doing is collaborating with them. We're collaborating with journalists who happen to find themselves in an evil system. So we're hacking an evil system, or, you know, I don't know if evil's the right word at all, but a system that has motivations of a certain sort that, you know, have nothing to do with getting the truth out there. It's completely other imperatives. But these human beings within it often do want to get the truth out. That's why they're in there. And so I think journalists understand as well as we do that it's a collaboration and that, you know, we're trying to give them funny ways of communicating this information. So we're kind of together hacking the system, although they would never be able to say that. We can say it.
So you become a role model for a whole generation of media activists. What are your role models, or where do you get your inspiration from?
No, we're not role models. The role models are, you know, I mean, it goes maybe Daniel Defoe in the 17th century, who made a fake pamphlet. There was a whole argument going on in England, a whole battle between the Protestants and the Catholics. It had to do, I can't remember what it was, some kind of thing. And he made a fake pamphlet saying basically that all the Protestants should be executed instead of this whole, like, because they were being barred from public service, they were being, you know, there were bills in Parliament to prevent them from doing this or that. And he said, you know what, let's skip all that preventing this or that, let's just kill them all, let's just execute them. And the Anglicans, the radical Anglicans, in the people on the other side, whoever they were, they actually publicly supported this idea. And then it was revealed to be a joke, and he was put in the pillory, but the crowd in the legend, the crowd, you know, when you're in the pillory, people are supposed to throw things at you. They threw flowers at him, and they loved it. So, you know, that's the, I mean, the role, who was his role model? Somebody who did that 100 years before, who we can't, we have no record of. And people have been doing funny things to kind of like, you know, using tricky means, trickster means to get, to fuck with the system, to hack the system. They've been doing that forever, since Roman, Greek, caveman times, who knows, you know. It's just, it's evanescent usually, it's ephemeral, I mean, and so you don't remember a lot of it. Like for us, in the most immediate, there's like the Yippies in the 60s, who did a lot of very, very funny things. You know, everybody knows about the dollar bills on the stock exchange, but they did a lot of things. And some of those things, like, I know about because people have told me about them, people who knew them, but you can't find any record of it. You Google it on the internet, it's gone. There's no, and there's lots of stuff like that. So, you know, people, yeah, I guess in short, here in Germany, there's the Kommunikationsguerilla that have done amazing things, you know, like quarantining an army base. There was like a, can't remember, you know this story, right? It's somewhere there was like an army installation, there was like some kind of army thing, like a parade or something that they were opposed to, and they called for a big protest, and so the police came out, but what they ended up doing was just establishing a ring around it, like a quarantine ring, with like wearing the white things and holding, you know, so it was very clear what they were doing, like, this is the plague and let's contain it. So instead of protesting it, they were just like keeping everybody aware that there was a, you know, really clever ways of communicating information, like guerrilla communication. So there's role models here that certainly we knew about.
Does the internet help you doing your ideas, or would you have been able to do it without the internet?
I think we could do it without the internet. I mean, obviously the things we do, we've done tailored to the internet. We choosing to send out many press releases or fake websites or whatever, it's all internet, but people were doing, you know, there's pamphlets, people passing out pamphlets, the dollar bills on the stock exchange telling reporters what happened. You know, there's all kinds of, I mean, it's just what we use now. But I think the importance of the internet is really overrated a lot. Like, do you know that in Egypt, the Facebook revolution, 2% of Egyptians had Facebook, 5% had Twitter, or maybe it's the other way around. Like, nobody had it. It's, like, totally unimportant. It's, like, it's infuriating. Like, it's so overrated.
Yeah, but it was important that most of the people at the Tahrir place at a special moment had smartphones to be able to mobilize lots of other people. But it was, internet was only a helper.
Yeah, barely. I mean, it had a role, but it was like one of many things that had a role, you know. More important was the printed stuff. That's what really got the word out, you know. More people actually read flyers than saw anything online, because most people didn't have online. So I think it was very important in communicating to the outside world. Like, Twitter was the news for the outside world and got the word out. So we in the West saw this Twitter stuff, but it was intended for us. It wasn't really for them. They were using other means. They were using ancient means, of, you know, or other, like, you know, more like means that people have used forever, like just paper and word of mouth and social networks, physical ones. But yeah,
it's now 1 year. Or close to 1 year after the Snowden revelation started. You are an American citizen. Mm-hmm. What do you think about it?
Great. I mean, wonderful that Snowden exists. And very sinister, but not unexpected, what he revealed. Like, it's kind of, yeah, we knew that. I mean, ever since September 11th, things have gotten incredibly weird and surveillance statey, but already before then, you know, I mean, it's been a long, of course, sinister government behavior is really old in the United States, as it is everywhere. I don't need to tell you that. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's nothing that surprising.
But do you feel that activists like you are under special surveillance?
Who cares? I mean, I guess we always have been. There's been, you know, what activists... I mean, I don't know. We're clowns, basically. What we do is we clown, and we try to get information out there. So, you know, if we're under surveillance, it's flattering. A lot more hardcore activists have been under surveillance for a very long time, like in the 60s, the civil rights activists, and 50s, 60s, civil rights activists were heavily surveilled. There was the whole COINTELPRO thing, you know, where they were faked. The FBI faked activists and communicated, you know, pretended to be them and made phone calls and sowed dissent. You know, very elaborate, very clever sort of things. And there was also just outright murder. They killed them. I think now we're at a point where things are a little different. There's surveillance, obviously. There's infiltration, obviously. But it's not threatening in the same visceral way, maybe, that was. Like, you had, you know, Americans are terrified of black people. The power is. And so that was especially terrifying, to see this real power arising that, you know, basically calls into question the whole legitimacy of the United States, in a way. So I think part of the very harsh, violent reaction to the Black Panthers and to the Black Power movement had to do with that. We'd be fooling ourselves to think that we are on the same level of threatening, or that hackers are on the same level of threatening. Maybe somebody like Edward Snowden is, maybe somebody like, you know, Julian Assange or so on, but generally we're not on the same level of threatening to the powers that be, I think, that those people were, just on the emotional level. It's like, and certainly not the Yes Men. And it doesn't do any good to be paranoid, or to think that you're being surveilled. I think it's really important for activists not to worry about it, and not to develop too much of a security culture and all that, except when it's really obviously clear that it's necessary. There are these moments, I guess, when you really need to have secrecy about an action or whatever, but momentarily and as little as possible, because otherwise you end up tying yourself in a knot and you end up crippling yourself. And you can't get anything done. You can't attract new members. You can't reach out and be open and get people excited. You can't do that anymore. And you can't even communicate amongst yourselves effectively or efficiently. So it's really damaging. And I think in our case, we keep relearning that lesson. And we keep, you know, like this last action we did, we weren't secret about it. We just, you know, we wrote to everybody we knew in D.C. We said, help us with this action. You know, there could be an infiltrator on our list who would then tip off the conference. It's never happened, you know.
Have you ever had legal threats or serious legal threats for your actions?
No, not serious ones, no. No, never. We've had a lot of, like, non-serious legal threats. We've had a lot of, like, you know, they're called cease and desist letters, where a corporation just automatically sends you a letter. You're violating some copyright or trademark bullshit, and so they send you a legal letter saying you mustn't do that, or we're going to sue you, and blah, blah, blah. And the good thing to do with those letters is to publicize them widely and say, look, they're really threatened. They're so scared. But the reality is that they're not threatened or scared. It's just something they have to do because of trademark law. Like, if they don't do that, then they lose their trademark, you know, or copyright. It doesn't actually mean anything. But it's good to say to the media, look, it means something, or it did for a while. That really worked for us. Like, it got a lot of press. It was very impressive. It's kind of a bit of a lie, though. We've only been sued once, and that was by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We impersonated the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and threw a press conference announcing on behalf of the chamber that they were no longer going to oppose climate legislation that was making its way through Congress. And a real representative of the chamber burst into our conference, our fake conference, and there was this wonderful altercation between us that was caught on camera. We had lots of cameras there. And so it became a big headline story. So their reaction made this a giant story. It was really funny footage. And I think they were so pissed off and so angry that they sued us for the whole thing. I think it was really personal, because it's not logical. Like, I mean, I think in that case it was personal, and I think they don't have the same public relations worries that companies have. Like, they don't have to worry about looking stupid or looking aggressive or whatever, because they're the world's largest lobbying firm, and their clients are large corporations. They don't care about the public. So they kept that suit continued, and we were defended by the EFF, of course, and we were it just sat on somebody's desk for maybe 3.5-4 years, and our lawyers at the EFF would write to them every once in a while, write to the judge and say, is anything happening with this? And then finally a new judge came in who decided to move on it and actually take it to court, and she was interested in it, and we were excited, and this was all going to finally, we were going to get to go to court. And then as soon as it started looking like it was going to happen, the chamber just dropped it completely without prejudice. So, like, no agreement, nothing. They just dropped it. We were very disappointed.
So you're doing this since 15 years. What tips can you give for younger media activists?
Well, tips. We've got a whole online database of tips that we're building right now. We're calling it a cookbook, activist cookbook, but it's we are in the process of building an entire platform that's going to be all about giving tips. So, and that is called the action switchboard. And so, like, if a young activist sees one of our actions or something else by somebody else, whatever, something that they want to do, it can be, if you haven't done this before, it can feel a bit daunting. Like, how do I do that? You know, it's easy. In reality, it's like a series of steps. It's not rocket science. It's like it's like baking a cake. You can do these steps and you can have your thing. But that needs to be communicated. So on this platform we've built, the Action Switchboard, is about people can log in with an idea, a vague idea, or even just a target. And we or some facilitators from the ESLab will put you in touch with other people that might want to work with you on it. They'll also give you feedback on your idea if you have one, or set up a brainstorm online to actually think through the idea or come up with an idea. And then you'll have a page. You can raise money for your action. You can attract more people from the internet to come be part of it. And then they'll just help you along the way with these cookbook docs, giving you tips on, okay, now here's how you do this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here's how you do that. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So that's what we're doing. There are lots of tips. And we only have tips for the kind of things that we've done. There's lots of other tips that are, out there. There's a wonderful book and website called Beautiful Trouble that has a lot of principles of activism, like ways of thinking about it and tactics that you can use. It's not so much a cookbook like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's more just like, think about things this way. This is a mistake to avoid. And that's also been a very valuable resource. So,
yeah, and we'll take a look on it.
Yeah.
And thank you very much for the interview.
Yeah, and thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, we wish you a very nice Republika.
All right, thanks. I'm going to enjoy it.